Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It has just turned the 10th of April, 2015, here in Japan, and today I'm joined on the line from the UK by our guest, Keelan Balderson. And if that name rings a bell to you from a previous Corbett Report interview, then congratulations, you have an extremely good memory. I'm looking at interview 300 on the Corbett Report website. That was now 4 years ago, so it's been 4 years since we've talked to Keelan. At that time, we were talking to him about the 7/7 bombings. He did some very important work on that, including a documentary called 7/7 The Big Picture that I hope listeners will already be familiar with, and if not, I hope they will check that work out at wideshut.co.uk. Keelan Balderson, thank you so much for coming back on the program today.
Well, thanks, James. It's a pleasure to be back after 4 years.
Yeah, well, a lot of catching up to do. Well, as I say, you are at wideshut.co.uk, and I've noticed a series of posts that you've done in recent months on a very interesting and I think timely topic for an investigation that we're doing at CorbettReport.com, as listeners may or may not know. Back in January, I started an open source investigation into pedophiles in politics, looking at some of the breaking headlines around the VIP pedophile ring in Westminster and the Epstein case in the United States. And of course, that opens the Pandora's box into all of the other political pedophilia scandals that have been uncovered over the years. And so we have started that open source investigation at CorbettReport.com. And after months of accruing data and going through data and sifting data and trying to make it into a narrative, I will be releasing the podcast of that that investigation very shortly. But before that happens, I wanted to talk to you, Keelan, about the work that you've been doing, recently on the Hampstead children abuse allegations that people may or may not be familiar with, and also an investigation that you did now 3 years ago into the Holly Gregg case. So these are a couple of cases of alleged child abuse that were picked up and heavily promoted in certain sectors of the alternative media, despite the flimsy and even non-existent evidence to back up a lot of these accusations. And that's what I want to concentrate on today. So for people who may not have heard of these cases, why don't we start? Let's start with the Holly Gregg case, which, again, I know you did cover a few years ago now, so I will call on your memory to try to drag up some of the details of this. But for people who are unfamiliar with that case, why don't you tell us just the details of what that case was and what it was about?
Sure. The Holly Gregg story, it first really emerged on the internet in late 2009 to early 2010. And it was basically an allegation that this young Scottish lady called Holly, she was an adult in 2009, and she's also a sufferer of Down syndrome, which is basically a condition that, it keeps you in a mental age of a child, all sorts of learning and social difficulties and whatnot. And it was claimed by Holly's mother, Anne, and a man named Robert Green, that from the age of six until basically her late teens, she was a victim of a paedophile network. Now, this so-called ring allegedly involved her father, her brother, friends of the family, but also people with a high standing in their local community there in Aberdeen. So a teacher was named and shamed, a police officer, a sheriff, which in Scotland is like a mid-level judge, and ultimately, upwards of 20 or more people were named and shamed online. Their names were printed on leaflets and were passed around the local community. Letters were sent to people's addresses, kind of outlining these allegations. And it was a very emotive story. This idea that somebody with severe learning difficulties could be targeted so horribly by this so-called network. It does kind of make you want to do something about it, and it really blew up online. The story went viral in much the same way that many of these kind of emotive stories go viral. I mean, you can think of like Kony 2012 and all that kind of thing. We had the Google Holly Gregg campaign that came off the back of this. People would sort of change their internet profile pictures to just the word Google Holly Gregg. I'm sure many of your listeners probably saw all that. And it kind of was spread all over social media. But people also, they took to the streets, they went on marches, handing out all of these kind of leaflets and things. Robert Greene, who, as I say, was kind of the main spokesperson of this, he did video conferences and traveled from town to town, village hall to village hall, kind of spreading the story. And a lot of alternative media also picked up on this and gave Robert Greene and Anne Gregg free rein to kind of just say what they wanted, really. But when you get down to it, nobody really seemed to ask the basic question: was this story true? Is the evidence there? Is what supposedly happened to Holly, is it true? And no one really put it through a critical lens or even tried to verify anything that was being said. But it really did snowball into quite a big campaign for a year or two there.
It certainly did, until such point as some people really did start to put it through that critical lens, as you say, and discovered not only that some of the evidence was flimsy, but some of it was non-existent, literally non-existent, including some of the people who were accused of being in this ring literally do not exist. Tell us about some of these details that problematize this story.
Yeah, so I'll take you through how I kind of got into the other side of the story. We're talking perhaps 2010, late 2010, maybe 2011. Not really sure now, it's been a while. But I came to the conclusion that I didn't know what happened. It wasn't necessarily that I knew the story was false, but I just not done the legwork to sort of verify the facts and make sure that what I was reporting was true. So I made the decision, because I mean, early on, I kind of jumped on the bandwagon, but I made the decision quite quickly that, hang on, maybe I'm jumping the gun here. So I took it all down from my website quite early on. And it wasn't until a good few years after that that the idea that the story might not be true began to surface a little bit more prominently. Lots of other people were sort of having doubts. It was popping up on Facebook and things. Groups were being started to talk about it and whatnot. And so I basically just had a look at what people were saying, and it quickly became apparent that Robert Greene, the spokesperson for the case, he was being very loose with the things that he was saying. For example, he made claims quite often that people with Down syndrome, this condition, can't lie. And it's kind of a ridiculous thing to say, really. There's no genetic condition or disease or whatever that forces people to tell the truth. Whether they know what they're saying is not the truth or not. There's nothing that, you know, no one is compelled to tell the truth, no matter what kind of problem they may suffer from. So just all kind of dubious things like that. And in the process of kind of looking at these ideas, I got in contact with a group of people who originally supported the story. They were kind of in the inner circle involved with the campaigning, and some of the people that were really close to what was going on. And they made the decision to walk away because they were discovering all sorts of different details that weren't really adding up. There was a spin going on. The side would claim that, oh, we have this kind of information, but they wouldn't release it. And those that did get hold of documentation and stuff, well, they determined that, well, there's more plausible explanations for some of this. And just a few examples of what I'm talking about. The sheriff who was named and shamed, it was alleged that abuse had taken place at his sister's house. So some research was done, and it came back and it was revealed that, well, he doesn't have a sister. So then it kind of backtracked and was, well, no, it was his sister-in-law, but he didn't have a sister-in-law either. So you have to wonder, well, if it happened at his sister-in-law or sister's house and he doesn't have any of these, well, is there really a house? And no one really described where this house was. There were certain names of people, as you say, who were allegedly involved in the case. And when you do some basic checking on public records and such, these people's names, they're just not real people. They're just random names that were thrown out there. There's another point. It was alleged that Holly's uncle was brutally murdered because he discovered the truth about this case. But it turns out, when you look at the coroner's report and whatnot, that he actually took his own life for unrelated reasons. He gassed himself in his car. That's a relatively common thing, sad enough. And the only physical damage that was recorded was from basically a passerby noticed what was going on, saw this guy in his car. The car had sort of caught fire by then. He pulled him out, did compressions to try and, like, you know, get him breathing again, and that caused a certain amount of damage. And I guess you can say we don't know 100% that that's what went down, but that was what was on the coroner's report. And over time, you basically start to see that all these points that were initially made in the beginning of this case, they become less convincing. They can be explained away in a more plausible manner. And you start to see how some of this stuff was spun or misrepresented. And the overall story just basically fell apart. So I, as I say, was in contact with this group. I spoke to two of the ladies that were accused by Ann Gregg and Robert Green. Seemed like perfectly normal people. They explained to me how their lives were absolutely ruined by these allegations. One of the ladies had to close her business because of all the rumors and gossip about it. And she maintains that she never even met Holly in any real way until she was 18. So, you know, how could she have been there when this supposedly happened from 6 years old and stuff? It's just, there's so much unsubstantiated information that was just ran out there with no second thought.
There certainly is a great deal of that information, and having just re-listened to a podcast on this that you did back in 2012, having just re-listened to it, I would recommend people to do that, where you talk about this information, you have interviews with some of the accused, you've gone over this, and you've pulled interviews with the BBC reporter who was going to run a story on this, but didn't end up doing it, and his confrontation, I believe, with Robert Green on air. Some very interesting and important information there. So we'll put a link in the show notes to this interview so people can listen to that entire podcast and really get the overall sense of this story. And I think, tellingly, since around the time that podcast that you did was assembled and some of this information was really starting to come to the fore, we've seen almost all of the people who were associated with this campaign back away from it and not necessarily denounce it, not necessarily retract what they were saying, but not so many people are on board with that campaign anymore, tellingly, I think.
No, yeah, like, there were so many talking heads in the alternative media. I mean, we don't really have to name them, but they were there at the beginning, kind of campaigning for it, pushing on their websites and going on radio shows all over the world, using it as an example for whatever they had going at the time, you know. I mean, it was interesting to see how whoever was talking about the story kind of had a different spin on it. You know, one day it was all about Satanism and the satanic elite that rule the world. Another day it was all about Freemasonry. Certain outlets made it more about how the courts are probably not up to scratch and how all that's a mess. It was almost like the perfect case that people just kind of pulled in different directions. And when it became apparent that actually there's no evidence for any of it, they just kind of backpedaled and didn't really even acknowledge that maybe they were wrong. I mean, I did jump on the bandwagon to begin with, and it's not surprising why people did. It's not like the state has a brilliant track record when it comes to things like this and just all sorts of different things. I mean, you know, whatever, but at least acknowledge that maybe you got it wrong and let's kind of talk about this and sort it all out. But, you know, people have their own agendas and whatnot, and they just kind of quietly stepped away from it.
Well, speaking of which, we're seeing, I think, a similar or at least a relatable phenomenon going on, as I say, in recent months with this Hampstead child abuse allegation video that went viral online and got a lot of attention. And I think we're seeing, if not directly analogous, at least a similar situation playing out with that, and one that you've been exposing, I think, quite quite well with some very exhaustive research you've been doing and a series of posts, again, up on wideshut.co.uk right now. Would you like to give us the short synopsis of the Hampstead case for those who haven't heard about it?
Yeah, so much like the Holly Gregg case, this recent Hampstead case, Hampstead is a place in North London, and it was very much a product of the social media viral phenomenon, how information spreads really quickly. Videos emerged online in early February of these two children making these really horrific allegations, implausible allegations, if we're honest, but really horrific and just weird and creepy stuff about a satanic cult who were operating out of a school and also in like the nearby church near the school and cooking babies and eating babies in secret rooms in McDonald's and making shoes out of baby skin and all this kind of stuff. And the videos really spread like wildfire all over social media. Immediately, certain websites wrote articles about how this was another example of the satanic, you know, elite and things. But nobody really considered, first off, what is this true? But also, these are young, innocent children. Should, regardless of what may have happened, should we really be spreading their faces all over the internet and, you know, crudely cropping them and pasting it on your blog and putting all their details and their names and that out there on the internet? It's just a little bit, it's a bit weird. And people were just running with this story without verifying anything that was said in the videos. And eventually it did turn out that the police did investigate the allegations. They interviewed the children. They went to this so-called church where some of this abuse was supposed to have taken place. They drove to some other locations that the children said, some other addresses, and they didn't add up to what they were claiming. Sadly, the children were medically examined, which is something that comes up a lot in these cases. People kind of overlook this side of these kind of stories, that when you make allegations like this, children are medically examined, and that itself is intrusive and not a nice experience for children. But they were medically examined, and it was determined that the evidence was basically inconclusive. What they found in the children and what was released in these reports, it's, you find the same kind of things in children that haven't been abused. So it's not a conclusive picture. They interviewed the father, who was supposed to be the leader of this satanic cult. They interviewed the mother, who was originally, you know, making the allegations. And ultimately, in the third interview with the children, after they checked out some of these locations, interviewed the mother and father and kind of, you know, tried to see what was going on here, the children backtracked on the allegations. They revealed that they were physically suffered physical violence at the hands of the mother's recent partner, and they were basically forced to make up the allegations by the mother's partner. And what's really kind of annoying about all this is you have all these people clinging on to the original videos that they saw on Facebook and what, you know, what they believed right away in the first day that these things came out, and they've clinged on to that the whole time. And these children have been abused. They've been violently abused, hit with spoons, sort of, you know, slapped around the ear and stuff like that. And people are ignoring that because they would rather believe these, frankly, impossible allegations about this satanic cult that nobody else has even come forward to even say had happened. So it's kind of a sad situation.
It is an exceptionally sad situation, and you point to some of the aspects of even the just spreading and making these types of allegations and spreading them without actually researching them. You've pointed already to some of the ramifications that this has on the people who are accused, obviously, and on the children who are really pawns in these types of games that are being played, often in custody disputes where one partner alleges abuse by another in order to get custody and things of that nature. Let's delve into this in more, in a little bit more depth, though. I mean, what is at stake? Why should we be so concerned about fidelity to journalistic practices and clinging to the truth in cases like this when we know that there is corruption and things that go on in the courts? So shouldn't we just be spreading this information to get people aware of this type of, you know, corruption that obviously is happening, whether or not it's happening in these particular cases?
Well, I think we're in a very unique time right now, where each and every one of us potentially can have a voice that can be spread to thousands and thousands of people online. You know, something you might have just discussed with a few friends down the pub 20 years ago, you can now spread to thousands of people on Twitter and Facebook. The nature of the internet has allowed people to have more of a democratic voice. And I think that is a good thing. It makes the democratic process more engaging. We don't have to rely on the mainstream media or the government to be the sort of purveyors of truth. If something isn't investigated right, or we think it's not being analyzed in the right way or whatever, we can do something about it. We can look at it ourselves and present a different side. That's very much what the Corbett Report is, and what I do at Wide Shut. We kind of try to pick up the slack where we think the mainstream media has failed. But at the same time, if we're going to replace the mainstream kind of mechanism of news or the way police investigations are done, if we're going to do sort of our own inquiries or whatever online, you kind of see it on Reddit, where people identify criminals that have not been identified through the regular channels, anonymous or whatever. They hack things and they get evidence about crimes that would normally go unnoticed. There is this mechanism. But if we're going to go down that road, and if we're going to get to the point where we're going to be in the streets protesting and putting people's names out there like vigilantes, we better be damn sure that we're correct with the information. We better have the evidence and a solid foundation for what we believe in. We better hold ourselves to higher standards than the mainstream. Because if we want to challenge them and say, look, you're doing it wrong, I can do it right, then, you know, do it right. Else, what are we really accomplishing? And I guess my fear with cases like the Holyrood case or this recent allegations of a satanic cult is that people have failed doing that in a spectacular way, and they're drawing conclusions and campaigning based on nothing more than a couple of YouTube videos or something they've heard on an alternative media outlet. If we're that careless, and I say we, but if people are that careless, you might just be giving the state the perfect reason to clamp down on the internet. If we don't use these tools wisely, then they might just take them away from us. You know, there's that old saying, with great power comes great responsibility. If we're going to use these tools, then let's be responsible about it. Let's make sure we've got everything nailed down before we just run off like headless chickens, you know, share, like, share. Like, just think about what you're doing before that.
That is such an important thing to reflect on, because obviously the Corbett Report is very much structured around this idea of the fact that we are in this incredible age where we do have a voice and we do have a growing amount of power to help spread awareness of various issues, to really change the societal conversation. And I usually frame this in a positive and hopeful manner, because I think it is positive and hopeful on the balance, but it does come with such responsibility that we literally can start witch hunts that will prosecute and lead to whatever kinds of consequences that can only be sort of thought of at this point. I mean, take a case like the Holly Gregg case. That's tragic enough for the people who have been falsely accused in a case like that. But then spread that, imagine that magnified thousands of times, and you start to get a sense of what can happen. And in fact, you mentioned Reddit identifying criminal suspects. Well, of course, we did see that during the Boston bombings, where we had some people who were identified by some of the sleuthers on Reddit as being the perpetrators of the Boston bombing. And it turned out that I believe one of them had been missing for weeks before the bombing and ended up dead, and his body had been decomposing to the point where he was dead before the bombings even took place. So he clearly was not responsible, and yet he was identified by name, and people were harassing his family because they got those details by sleuthing around on Reddit and things of that nature. It's not hard to imagine how this can go very, very wrong. And I think this relates back to what you identified earlier as the Kony phenomenon, where we are in an age where people tend to think that simply just retweeting or simply posting something to your Facebook is almost a stand-in for actual, not only actual research, but actual activism as well. And I think we have to be aware that, yes, it does have an effect when you spread this information, but if you are not 100% or at least as sure as you can be about the information you're spreading, especially when you're identifying individuals by name who can have their lives completely turned around by this type of information being spread, I think if we don't reflect on that fact and don't realize the power that we have here, it could go in a very, very bad direction. So what are some ways that we can, I mean, I don't feel that I have to address this to the audience that has participated, for example, in the latest open source investigation on pedophiles and politics, because if people go through the columns, the comments on that open source investigation, they'll find dozens and dozens and dozens, hundreds and hundreds of links to mainstream sources identifying various aspects of some of these scandals. I'm quite extremely impressed by the amount of research that's gone into this and the care that has gone into a lot of these links and these annotations. But again, it doesn't take much imagination to see how this could go wrong. What are some of the principles or rules or guidelines that people should be keeping in mind as we start to engage in this process of taking that power of the mainstream media away and becoming the alternative? What are ways we can avoid the pitfalls and traps that unfortunately all of us have fallen into at some point or another in our lives and could do so again?
It's a tough question. I think rumors and false stories have always been part of society. I don't think that's necessarily ever going to change. It's probably just human nature. But the onus really is on each individual person to try and not get swept up in the hysteria and the emotion of stories when they first hear them. I think that's a big part of the problem is having an emotional response or a sort of gut reaction instead of taking the time to step back and absorb all the information and look at it through a critical lens and looking at all sides of the story. That even applies to stories that for the most part are true. If you become overly emotional about them, you know, you can take it down a dark path that it doesn't need to go. I think we also need to be careful about going from quote unquote a mainstream sheep to an alternative sheep, but keeping the same mentality. The only thing that changes is the source of the information. Just because somebody might no longer have faith in the mainstream media doesn't mean that somebody who claims to be the alternative media is telling the truth. The same kind of incompetence, the same corrupting forces, whether that's greed or just some other agenda, the same forces are at play no matter what label you put on yourself. You know, whether it's the BBC or Bob's Truther blog, both can be equally biased and just incorrect in what they're reporting. And I'm not saying that from a high horse. We're all human. Humans are flawed. We get things wrong. But it's up to the person consuming the information to put it through a critical lens. Likewise, just because you might have a certain view of the world doesn't mean that when you read a story that confirms that view, that it's truthful and that you should accept it at face value. That's confirmation bias. So I think really it's about being honest with yourself and not getting wrapped up in emotions or particular ideologies or just following the crowd, following the herd. And look, I'm not perfect. I've altered and deleted articles. I've deleted videos, changed things on my website and YouTube channel lots of times because I've changed my opinion. I've become privy to something else. The Holly Gregg story itself, I ran with it in the beginning, basically just copy and pasted what amounted to a press release, and then thought, hang on a minute, I've not verified this. I'm going to delete it for now. And if I get the time to investigate it, then I'll investigate it. I think what we need to do is sort of just remove the emotions, take the ego out of the situation. If we're wrong, admit we're wrong, start a dialogue. And it just means being a critical thinker. It's not easy, but just whenever you see a story, just take a step back and really have a think about it.
I think there's a couple of things of import to highlight and underscore there. Firstly, that people can get their entire identities wrapped up with a story and invest so much into it that they don't ever want to have to admit to themselves that they were duped by it. And I think that can be a dangerous position to be in, so I don't think we should ever commit ourselves to that extent. And secondly, I think the way that I have tried to avoid that type of trap in my own reporting is that I always have considered myself an open source journalist, which is to say that this is open source intelligence. Here's what my take on this is, and here's the sources that I used to construct this. This is where I got my information. Now here's all the cookie crumbs that led me along this path, so you guys take it up and see where your research leads you. That's always been my take on what I'm doing and the path I'm taking. And now with these open source investigations that we started on the website in the past year, the analogy, of course, comes from the open source software movement, where the idea is if you have the source code open to everyone, open for inspection, open for a community to come along and tinker with and make updates and what have you, then no one individual in there is going to be 100% correct or have the perfect code, as it were. But the combination of people looking for flaws, looking for problems, and talking and arguing with each other and splitting off and trying different things will, in a sense, the process can be self-correcting at that point. And I hope that is the ultimate intention for this type of open source investigation. Do you see that type of analogy as having perhaps a potential potential model for how this type of internet journalism can proceed? Or do you have any other ideas for models for the journalism that we should be doing?
I think you have a good sort of grasp on it, because I think some people are too quick to have a position on a subject. If I use the Hampstead case, for example, people believed in the beginning, as soon as the videos went online, if their position was simply, we think this needs to be investigated, this is the information that we have so far, what are we going to do about it? I think perhaps the police need to do more of an investigation and follow up these leads. That's a sound position to take. But some people almost make their conclusions before, you know, they've even got the evidence for it. So I think the idea that spreading information, starting a dialogue, but not necessarily coming to a firm position right away is probably the right way to do it. If you become headstrong and you go out there campaigning because you think you've got the truth, you're gonna fall up short, you're gonna fall down a pitfall somewhere, and you're gonna look foolish. So yeah, I think you've got a pretty sound way of doing this, and of course, sources of information, we can only go on what there is in the public domain. Sometimes that will be credible. Sometimes we could be victims of false reporting. Getting everything rounded up into a big bundle and then looking at it is better than just deciding, you know, what the truth is based on nothing at all, just based on your hunches. I think sometimes people can sort of go in the other direction and say, well, because I'm sitting at home on my computer and I've not been to Boston, or I was not at the site of 9/11, and because I haven't seen it and I haven't experienced it, and I've not met the coroner in this case, and I've not met, you know, the hospital staff or whatever, then I'm going to come to the conclusion that it's all fake because I've not seen it. And you go down that road of the crisis actors meme and everything. It's tough from a distance to sort of quantify what's truth or what's true or what's not. But as long as you assess everything that's available to you and kind of balance it on the probabilities, well, why would a doctor lie? Why would the coroner make something up? Do you have evidence that would suggest they did make something up? And so on and so forth. It's just about looking at every angle, every bit of information, and then perhaps after it's been sifted through, then maybe coming to a reasoned conclusion. But you don't have to have a firm position.
Yes, I hear what you're saying. I think this is, again, this is not going to be a perfect process. It's not going to lead us to 100% truth every step of the way. And it's difficult to have faith in the overall process that this will eventually lead us towards a refinement, towards truth, if we continue to engage in this conversation. But that is, I think, the only way forward for this type of pioneering alternative internet-based journalism, because it has the chance to be an alternative to the systems of gatekeeping of information that have existed for so long. But those systems of gatekeeping of information at least did have the checks and balances, which of course we know are corrupted and corporate controlled and mouthpieces for various establishments, but they did have those checks and balances in place. I think we need some sort of check and balance in the alternative media as well, precisely for situations like the Holly Gregg case or the Hampstead case or various others that we can think about where things have spread too far too quickly and too definitively, and people have mounted entire campaigns without even being aware of the details of the case. That's the point of it that I think is particularly, perhaps not surprising, but disappointing, is that so many people don't even really know what it is that they're spreading. They're just spreading it because it, as you say, conforms to their worldview. So, again, there's a lot to go through here, and I think the end point here is that no one is going to be 100% certain or 100% perfect, but I think we have to be very careful when we are proceeding with investigations like this, and it is important to look at those cases where the alternative media has failed and try to improve upon the way the alternative media handled those cases. So I think there's a lot to go through here. I will, again, direct people to your to wideshot.co.uk generally, and, of course, to your podcast on the Holly Gregg case, as well as your recent work on Hampstead. Are there any other pieces of information or any other resources you'd like to direct people to?
Basically, yeah, everything's on wideshot.co.uk. My YouTube is /wideshotuk. I've got two core documentaries on there that I like to promote. That's the 7/7 documentary was 7/7, The Big Picture, but since then, perhaps a few months after that, I actually reworked it into a new title, 7/7, What Did They Know? And that basically looked at all the prior intelligence that was available to the authorities before the London bombings. I've also got a short film on the riots in England that happened a few years back. But yeah, just go to wideshot.co.uk. There's all sorts of articles on lots of different topics. Tons of podcasts with guests like Tom Secker, who I know you know, and just all sorts of stuff on there. Just go to wideshot.co.uk and you can check it all out.
All right. Keelan Balderson, we'll leave it there for today. Thank you very much for your time and efforts.
Thanks, James. It's been a good chat.